Hello and welcome to the Money Week podcast. I'm John Stepik, Executive Editor of Money Week magazine, and we've got something a bit different for you today. As many of you will be aware, we held an event, the Money Week Wealth Summit, here in London in November. It was a big success. I got to have a chat with many readers and listeners in person, and many of you said it was our best conference yet, so thanks for that. We'll be doing a lot more in the year ahead, so keep an eye out for announcements on that front. But for now, here's a recording of one of the speakers from the day. Now, I've known Jim Mellon, who's a British investor and entrepreneur, for over a decade now. He's a fantastic speaker, a regular attendee at our Money Week roundtables, including the most recent one, and a very sharp investor who's always been on the cutting edge. In this speech, he presents two huge investment themes that he reckons have the potential to be boom industries throughout the 2020s and beyond. And he also throws in a few thoughts about UK dividend stocks right at the end for the traditionalists. Now, this is a bit longer than a normal podcast, but it's well worth listening to the whole thing. So without further ado, I'll hand you over to Jim.
Thank you, Merrin, and thank you, John, and thank you, everyone at Money Week, and thank you, everyone, ladies and gentlemen, for allowing me to speak to you today, the last session before lunch. I'm going to talk about a variety of things. I'm going to talk about meta-theme investing, which is very important to us and our company. And then I'm going to give you a couple of more pedestrian ideas about how we might make money in the next year in a general way. But let's start with the meta stuff, if this works, which it doesn't seem to. I think we've got a little technical snafu. Oh, here we are. I don't know why I have this disclosure thing, since I'm not actually selling any public companies here. But I want to talk about meta-theme investing. You know, today and in other investment forums, there'll be a lot of talk about immediate opportunities, what you can do in commodities, what you can do in stocks, et cetera, and quite rightly, because that's what we're here for. We're here to learn about how we might make money over the next year. But longer term, we will only make real money if we identify great thematic trends, examine them closely, and put our bets on them in one area or another. And the three great thematic trends at the moment, in my opinion, are climate change and all its derivatives. I know there might be some climate change deniers in the audience, but my view is, whether you believe it or not, this is going to be a huge investment area. Secondly, clean meat and alternative proteins, which is a new area for us, but which I think is going to be a sensational area for investment over the long term. And I've been doing, although my day job is on longevity, I've been doing a lot of analysis with my colleagues on clean meat and alternative proteins recently. And lastly, longevity, which has the capacity, in my opinion, to change everything about our investment lives and our social lives and the trajectory of our lives generally. I've been looking at this area for 2 or 3 years. As you know, we formed a company named alongside the book as Juvenescence. The company has raised a lot of money in the last year. We've made some very interesting, I think, very interesting investments in this area. I have some very experienced biotech partners who are hugely successful. So this is, in my opinion, not science fiction. I think if we do live to 110 or 120, and that's based on current technology, not future technology, then you have to, first of all, change your financial structure. Secondly, adapt to the new environment. Thirdly, recognize that almost everything in the world will change. It'll be like waking up in the morning and having 36 hours ahead of you instead of having 24 hours ahead of you. It will absolutely radically alter the world. And it's the single biggest theme, I think, that I can identify for us to look at. Climate change, we all know, is a very, very major part of the political and economic landscape at the moment. And in this country, there's been vast investment in solar in wind farms and so forth. But there's been such a lot of investment in this area that the investment returns have been compressed down to sort of institutional rates. So you might be lucky to make 4 or 5% if you invest in a solar farm, or if you invest in a wind farm, and that's even with leverage. There are some areas of climate change investment that are interesting. Energy storage is one of them. I don't know enough about this area because we don't have sufficient bandwidth to cover everything to identify the real winners in the area. But I will say that the returns have been compressed because it's been evident to investors for the last 10 or 15 years that this is an area of great investment potential. And as a result, it's something that you may want to look at. Personally, I prefer to devote my energies to the two following meta themes. One is clean meat. Now, everyone will be familiar with Beyond Meat that went public in the United States earlier this year. It's about three times up. It was much more up on its IPO earlier on. It was a speculative boom, really. Beyond Meat makes a plant-based protein burger along with Impossible Foods, which is a private company at the moment. That plant-based burger has swept the world in the sense that it's now in Burger King, McDonald's, or equivalents. It's in almost every restaurant. Even my own restaurant, which is a huge money loser for me in London, has that burger. It hasn't done anything to change the economics, sadly. These plant-based meats are very different to the stuff that I'm looking at, or my colleagues and I are looking at, which is cultured meat, which is lab-grown meat and lab-grown products as alternatives to typical animals on a farm. I know Merin and Sandy, her husband, have some agricultural interests, and they don't necessarily appreciate me talking about this, but this is going to be a huge, huge industry. It ticks every box in the zeitgeist of our times. It is here now. It's not science fiction. The growth of cells in culture has been around for around 60 years. It's being refined and perfected. There are examples of this stuff now, not on the market, but in for display and for tasting and so forth. So it's here now, and it's going to grow enormously. And I will say that in this area, I've invented a phrase which no one else has ever come up with, and it's the only thing in my life I've ever invented. Many of you will know the term Moore's Law. Moore's Law was invented by Gordon Moore, founder of Intel, and he posited that every couple of years, the price of semiconductor power would come down by 50% and the output would increase by 50%. And that's applied for more than 40 years now. That's been correct. Although James Ferguson and his team now think Moore's Law's come to an end, it did work for a long period of time. So what I've invented is Moo's Law, right? The price of cultured meat will come down rapidly and is coming down rapidly, and the efficiency and the scale of it will go up. And within a short number of years, cultured meat will be on a parity in terms of cost with normal meat, but it will have some significant advantages to normal meat, and that's why you have to look at it as an area for investment. In a nutshell, this meat is grown in, and it's fish meat, it's beef, it's lamb, it's pork, it's sausages, it's whatever you want. It's grown in bioreactors from cells that are extracted from animals or fish without slaughter, except in the case of the fish, because sadly one fish has to die. The cells can be immortal, therefore you don't need to take another cell line out of another animal. And it is grown to identical specifications to the meat that we're all familiar with. But the advantage of it is it has almost no emission impact on the world. And you may know that animal husbandry is the biggest emitter of bad gases on the planet, leading possibly to climate change. You may know that 80% of antibiotics, or nearly 80% of antibiotics, go into farmyard animals, and that has potentially catastrophic consequences for us as humans, because we're now suffering from antimicrobial resistance, and that's a direct result of overuse of antibiotics in farm animals. There's a huge use of meat. Of water in the consumption or in the production of meat. And of course, it takes up a lot of land. So this stuff, the bioreactor manufacturer, if you want, of meat, takes up 1% of the land used to farm animals. That's without any ethical considerations about cruelty to animals and the way in which these animals are farmed. Some of you may not agree with any sympathy towards these animals, but I'm very sympathetic, and as a result, for more than 4 years, I haven't touched any meat, and I don't intend to, until the culture stuff comes out, I don't intend to eat it myself again. But let me give you one example, because I was shocked by this. Laura Turner, who's here, my colleague, who's an analyst on this area for us, Myself and Anthony Chow, who some of you know, were in Berlin recently for a presentation by a company which is making milk proteins, substitutes for traditional dairy products. A dairy cow that's used in a farm is constantly pregnant, as you probably know, otherwise they don't produce milk. The size of their udders gets so big that the spine collapses. The calves are ripped away from the mother because they're always pregnant, and it's a very, very traumatic thing. And they live between 3 and 5 years, typically, compared to something like 15 or 25 years if they were just left out in the field to live their lives in peace. It's a very cruel industry. I did not know that. You see the pictures of the happy cows in the alpine slopes, you know, with the bells around their necks. That's not the reality. It's a horrible, industrialized, cruel industry. These guys are producing milk proteins, which will be on the commercial market within 3 years, and they're doing it for cheese. The biggest selling cheese in the world is mozzarella, and their first product will be mozzarella. But it's not the only one. It's not the only thing that's interesting in this area. As I said, there's beef, and the price is coming down with Moore's Law dramatically. There's pork. There will be chicken. There are lots and lots of things happening in this industry, but it's a very early stage industry. Only about $130 million has gone into these companies so far. So we have a company called Agronomics, which is listed and which we're very excited about, and which I'm investing in this current funding round myself on the identical terms to investors, and we don't have a management fee on it. There is a performance fee, but it's only triggered on realizations. So I'm super excited about this area. It's a $7.3 trillion industry. This is the farmed animal meat business. And you know, the Chinese and the Indians, they want proteins like we do, and there just isn't enough to go around. Now, some of you will be aware that in China at the moment, there is swine fever sweeping the country. 2/3 of the pig herd has been killed since the beginning of this year. There are not enough breeding sows, and that's because the pigs are kept in close confinement, sometimes in the same house as human beings. That swine fever has led to a trebling of pork prices in China. And there are some economists who say that that is more important than what's happening in Hong Kong, because pork prices, I don't know if you would agree with this, James, are a very important component of the Chinese CPI. And one of the reasons why China's inflation is going up rapidly, and therefore there might be societal disturbance beyond Hong Kong, is because of the trebling of pork prices, a direct result of the way in which pigs are currently cultivated. If we could do it in the way that I just described to you, I think there's a phenomenal long-term opportunity for us, and hence the second meta theme. But the one that I spend my time on mostly, and which I've been crisscrossing the world on in the last 3 years since I started research on this area, is longevity and juvenescence. Now, we know that all of life expectancy increases since 1900 and before have occurred as a result of an improvement in environmental factors. So, better sanitation, less infant mortality, vaccinations, antibiotics, less accidents at work because of less manual labor and so forth have been the reason why life expectancy has gone from 47 years in London in 1900 to in the 82 or 83 for a woman today. None of it has occurred as a result of any biological evolution of human beings. So if you take someone from 1900, you give them all the advantages that we have, they'll live just as long as we will. We live in the first cohort ever on the planet for whom bioengineering is not just possible, but it's here. There are gene therapy companies out there that are working on very obscure diseases, but this is just the tip of the iceberg. We are now able, both in animals, organisms, and ourselves, to manipulate our fundamental biology to allow us to live longer, but more importantly, healthier. So 16% of people's lives at the moment are characterized at the end of their life by the presence of one or more disease states. That's called the period of morbidity. So you might have heart disease, and if you're cured of heart disease, you might get cancer. And if you are cured of cancer, you might get Alzheimer's disease. It's a bit like whack-a-mole. There are great therapies evolving from almost every disease, and possibly even including Alzheimer's disease. But ultimately, people end up, no matter how healthy you are, no matter how well you look after yourself, with something that's horrible, generally speaking, towards the end of their life, and sometimes two or three diseases at once. So our objective in this longevity science is to compress that period of morbidity. The best thing ever would be to be in your bed at the age of 120 and just die in your sleep. We will die. There is no cure for death as yet. And in fact, I don't think there ever will be a cure for death. But we will die in a state of reasonable robustness as opposed to in a state of infirmity. And if you think about the huge amounts of money that are spent in the last part of people's lives, it's, you know, something like two-thirds of all health expenditures are in the last 3 years of a person's life. And we know about all the old people who are in hospital because there's no other place for them to go. The social care is inadequate. We know, you know, the effects of infirmity and lack of robustness and old age, and many of us see that in our relatives or friends. If that period towards the end of life could be a robust period, then actually the burden on the healthcare system would go down. It wouldn't go up. And that's the great thing about preventative medicine vis-a-vis longevity. So life expectancy has improved because of environmental factors. It's sort of plateauing at the moment. And that's because none of the therapies, none of the drugs that I'm going to describe some of, are in wide dispersal at the moment, but they will be within the next 10 years. And then the real effects of this longevity science will become evident to everyone. And we will all be taking something. We will all have some therapy that will be applied to us because everyone wants to live longer and in better health. And the science is now catching up with that aspiration. It's no longer science fiction. And that's why we're so lucky to be the first cohort on the planet for whom this is possible. Now, Madame Jeanne Calment is the oldest properly recorded person ever to have lived. And there is some doubt about, there's some sort of scandal about her, whether her daughter substituted for her. But I think realistically, she was the oldest person ever to live. This is a picture of her on her 121st birthday. She gave up smoking on her 117th birthday. And like everyone else who lives to over 110, they're the so-called super centenarians. They have a reason why they live so long. I drank rum. I didn't drink rum. I walked every day. I didn't walk. I sat in front of the TV and watched shows. I didn't do that. I ate whatever. I ate kale or I didn't eat kale. In her case, it was having as little as possible to do with men, which some of you may find amusing. She died at 122. She lived in the same town. The fact of the matter is that all these super centenarians have genetic profiles that are different to people who don't live above 110. And some scientists, notably Nir Barzilai, who was here at our longevity forum last week, are working on finding out those genes that they have that could be inculcated into the general population. But I do not take that gene therapy or that genetic manipulation into account in calculating that all of us in this room have a fighting chance of living to 110 or 120. Living to 110 or 120 is based on therapies that are here today, not future therapies, not gene therapy. The general trajectory will be small molecule drugs, which my team is, the people I work with are expert in, stem cells, organ regeneration, microbiome. Those are the things that are here and now. And I'm going to show you some examples of that. And those are the things that will keep us alive to 110 or 120. But there is someone, probably in this room, who will live to over 150 because of gene therapy, because of CRISPR and all this sort of stuff that's out there now. And I just want to tell you, I mean, Merin talked about books that I've written. The first book I wrote on bioscience was called Cracking the Code. It was a description of the industry as it then was. The four key things that are on this slide that have developed since then did not exist 7 years ago. Artificial intelligence for the design of novel compounds did not exist. One of our companies in silico recently published in Nature magazine that they could produce novel compounds in 26 days as opposed to 3 years in the canonical way. That's amazing. That opens up the potential of an era of personalized medicine where an AI machine produces a drug for you, for you, for you, and for me. an individual drug based on our own gene makeup. Cancer immunotherapy, everyone will be familiar with that, did not exist 7 years ago, and now it's the gold standard of care in, for instance, liquid cancers, and I'm telling you now, that will be a $180 billion sales industry by next year. That didn't exist 7 years ago. The cure of hepatitis C didn't exist 7 years ago, and now if you've got the money, you can be cured of hepatitis C. Cured by one course of pills. And lastly, and not least, CRISPR, the way of gene editing, which is going to be very important in longevity. The papers had only just been published 7 years ago. Now there are multi-billion dollar companies formed around that industry. So I don't know what's going to happen in the next 7 years, but I know it's going to be good. It's going to be great. It already is evolving into be great, and longevity will be a very, very big part of that evolution in biotech. Now, what is aging? Well, we're all familiar with what it looks like. Some of us may be familiar with what it feels like, but generally speaking, it is thought now by scientists around the world to be a form of antagonistic pleiotropy, don't worry, I'll kind of explain it if I can, and hyperfunctioning of genes. And the best way of describing that is that the genes that work really well in our development phase, when we're going through puberty and we're growing fast, work against us in old age. So it's described as being like a bath. You're in the bath, it's filled to the brim, everything's fine. But you keep the bath taps running, and eventually the bath brims over, the water gushes down, the floor collapses, the neighbors get angry, and everything goes into entropy and chaos. And that's what aging is. It's the hyperfunctioning of genes that work against us in our older age. Aging is not predestined. There are creatures out there that exhibit negligible or no senescence at all. The American lobster is an example. There are plenty of creatures out there that don't die, or if they die, they die because they're predated or they have an accident or something else happens to them, but not because they age. We are just atoms and molecules like they are. With the unveiling of the human genome, with the amazing collaboration around the world of using the internet, the explosion of knowledge in this area, the manipulation of our atoms and molecules to create negligible senescence will become possible. It's not part of my 110 to 120-year-old forecast, but it will be a very key feature in future science and development. There are many genes that have been discovered implicated in longevity as a result of the unveiling of the human genome and as a result of the improvement in the use of computers to identify them. Plenty of them you will be familiar with, I would guess. GDF1, possibly, mTOR. There is one called INDI, which stands for I'm not dead yet, genuinely. But there are plenty of genes, and all of those genes so far have been proved to be malleable. In other words, they can be altered in some way, overexpressed or underexpressed, with an effect on lifespan and health span in organisms, and now in human beings. So it's a very exciting period to be alive, but you have to stay alive for the next 10 years because none of this stuff will be on the market probably for 10 years. There are some self-experimentation that's possible at the moment, but generally all this, the stuff, if it's going to be safe, will not be on the market for about 10 years. So it's a statement of the obvious, right? We all know that we have to floss. We all know that we have to do some other things. I won't go into all the details, but red wine, as an example, contains resveratrol. It's supposed to be positive for aging, but you have to drink 5 bottles a day in order to get a benefit. I do know some people who make a good go on that. Luckily, one of our companies is involved in organ regeneration, and we will be able to regrow your liver. So, you know, in a couple of years' time, down to the Wetherspoons and crack them open. There are some things that are available now, but they probably don't work. So Kim, whatever he was, one of the Kims, the dear leader, ordered his doctors, but when he was 82, to keep him alive till he was 120. Well, he made it to 82 because he died a few months later, and I imagine that his doctors didn't live very long thereafter either. So just ordering your doctors doesn't work. There's parabiosis, and you may know about the old mouse being sewn to the young mouse, and some effect is possible or evident in the old mouse, but we don't really know if there's a positive or a negative effect, so I wouldn't do that. You can hook yourself up in California to a young Silicon Valley boy or girl, and for $8,000 a go, see if observe if you have some effect or not. Caloric restriction. I'm actually doing the intermittent fasting at the moment. It's not going to add very much to my lifestyle, but I did it as a bet with a friend, so I'm on my ninth day at the moment, and I'm allowed to eat after 12 o'clock, and you're not allowed to eat after 8 o'clock at night, so 16 hours of no eating. But it might add 5% to your life, but it will just feel like a very, very long life, so I don't recommend that. But we are working on mimetics of caloric restriction, so things like a ketone ester that you can drink in the morning, $5 shot, bit like drinking, you know, that stuff in the morning, Actimol or something like that, except with a longevity benefit. And we're working on that at the moment. We'll have it on the market in the United States in the middle of next year. So it's not science fiction. And there are some things that you can do now. Near Barzilai, pictured here, is the world leader in metformin research. Metformin probably will add 3 to 4 years to your life if you take it. It's a diabetic drug. It's been observed over millions of people since 1957 to probably have a pro-longevity effect. And there is a trial that is going to start in the United States very soon under the auspices of Near Barzilai to see if it works. So it's 6,000 elderly patients. Some will be on metformin, non-diabetics. Some will not be on metformin, and he'll just observe who lives and who dies, basically. So one of those sort of trials. They call them adverse events, the deaths. Yeah, euphemistic. And then there's NAD plus supplements you may have heard of. There's rapamycin, which certainly extends the life of big dogs and possibly will extend the life of humans. But at the moment, in its current state, it's toxic in humans. One of my dogs, Horatio, is actually on rapamycin, and I have to say it's had a very positive effect. And the great thing about dogs is that there's no placebo effect. If I give you all a pill, some of you a placebo pill, some of you a regular pill, the placebo arm will undoubtedly react as well, positively, because we think we associate pills with good health. Dogs don't know they're getting pills, so there's no placebo effect. So they're great models for the study of novel compounds. But coming soon, right? So you may have heard of senolytic drugs, and if you haven't, you should. Judy Campisi of the Buck Institute in California, a leading anti-aging institute, worked out that senescent cells, those are cells that are between healthy functioning and death or apoptosis, cause a secretory phenomenon known as the SASP. The SASP causes a lot of the infirmity in old people. It's the buildup of those senescent limbo-like cells that causes that. So things like age-related macular degeneration, osteoarthritis, lack of robustness, lack of balance, they are all caused by the buildup of senescent cells. Now, very briefly, she worked out a compound to remove senescent cells in animal models. So if I can just point out this mouse on the right-hand side, the same mouse, all right, so the top one is a picture of him or her at the age of 95, human equivalent, all right? Has all the attributes of a very elderly human being. So it's got cancer, reduced locomotion, can't see, can't hear, it's a very miserable mass. It's treated once in very late age, so there's hope for people who are relatively old. My father is 90, I keep telling him that he'll be on the pills very soon. It's treated once to remove senescent cells, and it goes back to being a middle-aged mouse within 6 weeks. And this is not just a one-off, right? This is done in many thousands of mice. This is the removal of senescent cells. This is one element in the armamentarium of the longevity industry today. Now, this is in human trials now in a company called Unity Biotech. We don't know whether they're going to succeed or not, but we know that senolytic drugs generally will succeed in the future. They may have to be tweaked, but this will happen to us within 10 years. There will be some age reversal, some age slowing, some age halting as a result of the development of senolytic drugs. So watch out for those. Secondly, individuals have been trialed, humans have been trialed on a combination of dasatinib and quercetin, and there's been remarkable improvement observed. These are human beings, these are not mice, all right? And then a guy called Steve Horvath, who invented the biological clock, which is a clock that measures our true age as opposed to our chronological age, put some people on a trial with metformin, DHEA, a version of human growth hormone and vitamin D for 12 months, and their age reversed biologically by 1.5 years. So this is a recent trial. This came out, the results came out about 6 weeks ago. I want to talk about one of our companies, Ligenesis. This company will be in human trials in a phase two. As you probably know, in the FDA, there's phase one, phase two, phase three. Phase three is the big broad trial. Phase two is the proof of efficacy. Phase one is toxicity. It's going straight into sick patients with liver failure in the first half of next year. So we're very, very close to patients being treated here. This is sounds like science fiction, but the FDA has approved this trial. What is it? At the moment, if you've got liver failure, and there are an estimated 7 million people with terminal liver failure in Europe and the US combined, there's not much hope for you unless you can get a liver transplant. And the livers are not very prolific. People are not falling off their motorbikes as often as they once did. So there are not enough livers out there. And besides, the liver transplant takes 15 hours on average. In the US, it costs $750,000. So what to do, right? Just let the patients die. So this company out of the University of Pittsburgh worked out if you take a cadaver liver, you divide it into 75 pieces approximately, and you insert one of those 75ths of a liver into a lymph node adjacent to the failing liver in an animal, because it's only been done in animals so far, a new liver will develop. And so this has been done in 600 animals now, including dogs and pigs that have very similar organ structures to us, and not one has failed. Every single one of them has grown an ectopic liver in the lymph node bioreactor. Every single one of them has, which is very rare in biotech. And so it's going into sick patients in the first half of next year. And if it works, amazing, amazing. But the real trick for us in the longevity business is the restoration of the thymus from which the immune system develops. So your thymus, T cells, bone marrow, B cells, the B cells go to the thymus to be matured. The thymus, which sits above your heart, is the T cells. So it's very important. But in old people, it involutes, it shrinks to almost nothing. So if you can restore the immune system by regrowing the thymus, hey presto, you've restored a large element of senescence in the elderly. So they are doing trials in animals at the moment. Now, I don't know if this is going to work, but it's super exciting as a prospect. And it's just super exciting for us as human beings. Lastly, I talked about AI in development of new compounds, personalized medicine. In silico medicine, our own company just had a big funding round. It was led by all the big Chinese partners, Baidu, Kunming Ventures, and so forth. And it's very exciting. They can develop novel compounds really, really quickly. So, and then biomarkers of aging are going to be very important because if you think about it, if I develop a drug and I give it to you and I say you will live another 30 or 40 years or you live another 10 or 20 years in robust health, we have to hang around for a long time to see if it works. So there are two things about that. The first is we have to develop something for a condition, for a medical condition that has immediate or soon to be commercial application. We can't just develop a drug for longevity because we don't know if it works. And the second thing is we have to observe the patients who are being treated with this drug for a specific medical indication to see if their biological age reverses, slows, or halts. So, because we have to have biomarkers to show whether this thing works. And there are some hallmarks of aging, well-established hallmarks of aging, that we see whether they work or not. Because we can't hang around for 30 or 40 years. So the biomarker side of the business is really important. And this is something that we look at very closely. And then, of course, these are the trajectory of the drugs and therapies, according to an estimate. It's probably entirely wrong, but it's according to an estimate that we've done of what will be on the market over the next 40 years. But there will be a lot. However, I will say this is a nascent. This is a primitive industry as yet. And there are failures and there's, you know, it's a very evolving, fast evolving, but very evolving science. That gives us opportunities as investors, but also creates pitfalls, as we well know. But I compare it to the dawn of the internet. We all remember most of us remember the dial-up phase of the internet, frustrating. What could you do with the internet? Now it's woven into our lives. But at one point, it was really, yeah, so what's its use? And it will be the same with this longevity industry, except it will be bigger, because every single person on the planet is a potential customer. So Aubrey de Grey, who's on the right-hand side here, was at the conference last week, was a prophet of this industry 20 years ago. And he's a prophet who's coming in from the wilderness, because some of the stuff that he has predicted is now coming true. So these will be the players on the right-hand side, equivalent to the internet players in the mid-1980s. And this will be a bigger boom than anything we've ever seen in the world stock markets. It'll be bigger than Bitcoin or cannabis. This will be an absolutely enormous boom. And there are more and more companies coming into the field. So we started our company. My partner, Dek Dugan, was the head of R&D at Pfizer for a long time. He developed many drugs there. He then went on to be the CEO of Amarin, which is a hugely successful company that's developed, and he did this ultra-purified fish oil. Amarin is about a $7 or $8 billion company today. Then the three of us started a company 4 years ago called Biohaven, which is about $3.5 billion in market cap, and we started it 4.5 years ago with $3 million. So we have an approvable drug for migraine. So you can develop drugs quickly. You can get them to market quickly. This will be on the market in the United States sometime next year. We raised $170 million. It's a company. It's not a fund. And we will take the company public at some point. So, you know, watch this space for that. And we've got about 15 shots on goal because we don't really know what's going to work. We just know that we need two or three things to work and we'll be financially successful. The pace of money coming into this area is similar to the technology companies in the early 1980s and beyond. So there is money coming in here, some quite big money. SemiMed has raised a lot of money at a $16 billion valuation. It's a private company. Google has put $2.5 billion into its longevity subsidiary, Calico. And there's some, you know, some fairly serious money being raised. And when I did this about a year ago, there was about half the number of companies on the slide. Now you can see that there are a lot more, and I'm sure there'll be a proliferation. It'll be a bit like cell culture. It will grow, you know, enormously as the industry becomes more attractive to financiers and to charlatans and to the usual scamsters who jump on every bandwagon that's out there. So here are some opportunities in biotech stocks. You can have a look at them. I'm sure these slides will become available if you want them. As an example, Restore Bio had a failure in a trial last week. The share price fell by 90%. This is typical of biotech, unfortunately, if you get it wrong. It was using a rapamycin analog to try and boost the immune system in the elderly. It didn't work, but they've got great data in Parkinson's disease. And they've got three times more cash than they have market capitalization. So I think it's a rather interesting speculative buy at the moment. But there are not many companies that are public, but there will be a lot more as the years go on. And Money Week follows this area. They will be, for sure, introducing more companies. Markets develop very quickly in this area. I mentioned cancer immunotherapy. It's exploded in the last few years. Biologics are now about a third of the whole worldwide drug market. So it's entirely possible that longevity drugs could be a very big part of the biotech world relatively soon. The wealthy, as you know, will be willing, this is a UBS survey, to spend a lot of their money on getting 10 years of extra healthy life. There will be plenty of people who will be prepared to spend something in this area. And ultimately, it will be more or less free to all because all drugs come off patent after 20 years, generally speaking, and take about 10 years to get onto the market in most cases. So there's 10 years of commercial exploitation. We live a relatively long life, so everyone around the world will be able, rather like ulcer drugs, which were once very expensive, to get these drugs for low cost in boots over the counter. So just have a look at this, because you know everyone who's doing a sort of low-cal diet and you know not drinking any red wine, all that sort of stuff, sooner or later, you'll regret that because everything will be available through a pill, and all the clean livers will feel let down and disappointed that their friends are still alive when they should be dead. Now, very quickly on the global outlook, basically, I think there's two or three opportunities that are worth pursuing in the next year. You know, I'm sure that James and others have talked about the misallocation of capital as a result of the monetary policy. James thinks that monetary policy is going to go absolutely nuclear, in which case, you know, it's getting even worse for efficient capital markets. But the central bank tinkering is very destructive, in my opinion, to the long-term performance of economies, which is why productivity and why economic growth has collapsed really around the world and will continue to do so. So what do you invest in? So gold. I know that James and Russell have been promoting gold. I've become a big believer in gold myself. I'm long a lot of gold at the moment. So if you watch me later on looking at my phone, it's because I'm checking the gold price. Silver is the same, platinum is the same, derivatives of gold, you know, mining stocks and so forth. I think you absolutely have to have a high percentage of your portfolio in there. And I am doing exactly that. But you can't just invest in gold or silver. So why is it that in a world of negative interest rates and very low yielding bonds, the dividend stocks are still yielding relatively strongly? Is it because the dividends are going to collapse with an economic collapse? I don't think so. So some companies we've identified, and I put quite a lot of money to work in this dividend portfolio, as being interesting. For instance, Lloyds Banking Group, I think it's an unimpeachably strong bank. I don't think it's going to go bust. It may not grow much, but you know, it's got a dividend yield of 5.4%. That's a hell of a lot better than putting your money on deposit with Lloyds. As you probably saw recently, Green & King was bought by a Hong Kong company for a large amount of money. I looked at an equivalent. Marston's, to me, looks pretty interesting, and it's got a 6% yield while you're waiting. So, and it's 9x earnings. So there are stocks out there that I think are attractive and interesting, and I think these will take over from the growth stocks that have led the markets in the last 2 or 3 years. One way of enhancing income on these, it's a little bit technical, but is to sell calls. So for instance, if you buy Lloyds Bank and you sell calls at 15% above the current share price, you take in an extra income. And if the share price goes up by 15%, you get called on your call, but you don't care because you're up 15%, plus you've got the dividend, plus you've got the capital gain. So what we do, if we were more efficient, we would do this and it better than we currently do. We have our dividend portfolio and write calls against everything. But you have to watch very carefully on the liquidity and the trading costs of doing these call writings. So just be very careful on that strategy. But I think generally it's a good strategy, and it reduces the volatility of your portfolio and enhances your yield. And it also takes advantage of time decay. But, you know, this is something I just throw out there as something you might want to look at. And I do think the Tories are going to romp this election, so I wouldn't be too worried about Mr. Corbyn getting in. And if they do, then they've got 5 years. They've got 5 years. With 5 years, you know, they can do quite a lot that's positive for our economy. And this economy will grow quickly, which is why I would back up the truck into British pounds against the dollar or the euro and against some of these dividend-yielding stocks that I mentioned earlier on. But I'm going to finish now by saying $140 billion a year of spending on anti-aging products at the moment, creams, potions, you know, crap, basically. None of it works. Just imagine that if the stuff worked, how big this industry would be. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed.